to me, it felt like for the first time, I was able to say, hey, here's a set of problems that we're going to be seeing in 20, 30 years. Let's fix them now. And that's what we're doing.
I'm Sean Garrity, and this is The Answers Are Out There. On today's show, Brianna Warner went from a life of international diplomacy to problem solving for Maine's climate-threatened lobster fishery. She's now building a community-driven industry out of a surprisingly dependable new crop. Brianna, thanks very much for being with us here. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sean, for having me. It's wonderful to be with you, and I'm just thrilled to have this conversation.
There's a lot of things you can imagine I want to ask you, but I think a lot of listeners have never been to Maine. Probably the majority of them have never seen the beautiful coast of Maine. I'm very fortunate that I have. Could you paint a picture of where you are and what these little towns are like and what the culture is like and the lobster fishery and that whole thing? Paint a picture for us.
Nobody's ever asked me that question before, Sean. And I actually just got a little teary when you asked, because it is, Maine is a place like no other. I'm not of the place. I'm not from here. I grew up in central Pennsylvania, and then I spent the next 14 years traveling around the world as a U.S. diplomat, and never ever have I been to a place that feels quite as special as Maine. Like you said, for people who are fortunate enough to get up here, they leave a piece of themselves here. People are always kind of, Maine gives people this allure that they always want to get back and they don't know why. It's always pulling everyone back. And I'm so fortunate to have made a career here and a life here, but to kind of paint the picture of what that looks like, you know, some statistics. I'm an economist, so you start with statistics first when you paint art. But the southern part of the state, which is Portland South, is about half of the state's population, despite the state being about the size, you know, being the largest state in the East Coast. And Portland is only an hour north of the border from New Hampshire. And it's a massive state with only 1.2 million people. And so the rest of the state, it is the most rural state in the continental United States. So more than Montana, shockingly, Sean. Yeah. It's the most naturally forested state in the continental United States. And 3/4 of the state don't even have roads, let alone stoplights. Mm-hmm. On the coast, it's this beautiful rocky coast that is unmatched, unparalleled to any other coastline I've seen. It just drops off into cliffs into the ocean. It feels rough and real and cold and wistful. And along that coast, you have 4,000 plus lobster license holders, people who are owned by nobody, people who work for no one but themselves. There are no fleets of fishing boats allowed in our lobster industry. If you are on your boat, you have your license.
And that's pretty unique, right?
It's singular. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's one other fishery in the entire U.S. that's like that. It's a salmon fishery in Alaska. Mm. But even in Alaska, you can sell your license. In Maine, you can't. It's a generational fishery. Wow. You can't even pass it on. Mm. If you want to be a fisherman, you start when you're a middle schooler.
Yeah.
And once you can apprentice several thousands of hours, then you can fish. But you can't apprentice unless you have a family member that's willing to give you thousands of hours on their boat. So it's a family business. It's a generational fishery. And there's 4,000 plus lobster license holders who answer to no one.
Yeah.
And that's not true in Washington. It's not true in Oregon. It's not true in California. It's not true in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, anywhere. And so we have these thriving fishing communities that you look off these rocky coasts and you think no one lives out here. And there's probably about 400 people that do. And half of them are on boats fishing for lobster. It's a lobster monoculture. We are overly dependent on this lobster, but it is the last kind of frontier in the continental United States where people are just completely free.
How does this scene you're painting, is really interesting, how does that then come into the culture of people? What are they like, these people who live in this environment you've described so nicely?
Fiercely independent, but also fiercely supportive. You know, to zoom out for a minute, one of the things that I get asked a lot is, you know, how do you work with fishermen as a woman? Like, do people treat you differently? I'm like, no, it's the venture capitalists who are assholes. Fishermen, if I need anything, I have 27 partner farmers that would show up in a second. This is an incredibly tight-knit group of people in the state of Maine. There's 1.2 million of us. And these are people who are there for each other. These are people whose families have long, long, long histories, but also we stay out of each other's way. You know, we're all fiercely independent, but we check in on each other.
Yeah. So you've gotten us to where you are now. You've also had more than a somewhat interesting background in the Foreign Service. Can you give people a little bit of that who don't know your trajectory? Just kind of give us a summary of some of the places you've lived and the type of work you did there. And I'm interested in how that has shaped you, how you see yourself, and how it shaped some of your goals.
Yeah. So I grew up in central Pennsylvania. It's an old natural resource focused town that died a long time ago with the natural resources that went out. And I'm 39. And I remember in 1990, when the Gulf War started, there were yellow flags everywhere throughout town. Those little yellow ribbons. Do you remember those, Sean, that everybody had up for the Gulf War? And I was really confused as to why they were hanging everywhere. And my mother and father said, well, you know, they're going to fight the bad guys in Iraq. Because, you know, I was 6, 7. And I said, well, but why? Like, couldn't someone have prevented this? And I kept asking why. And they said that they were just being run mad by my whys. Like, but this doesn't make sense. And they would explain it. And I'm like, no. But why did we get here? There seems to be a lot of ways that we could have solved this before we got here. You know, unfortunately for them, they finally got to the answer I was looking for, which is, well, that's why we have diplomats. They're supposed to be preventing these things. And I was like, well, that's what I'm going to be. that's it. That's what I'm going to do. And so I pursued that. So I was in college and was recruited by the State Department as someone who couldn't pay for college on their own very well. As a woman leader, they were the U.S. Foreign Service is white male in Yale. It does not reflect our country.
Yeah.
The people who become diplomats do not look like Americans.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't look like everybody else in the Foreign Service, and I didn't have the background of everyone else in the Foreign Service. They're working at the time to diversify post September 11th.
Yeah. And I think I read somewhere you were studying classical Arabic at the time.
I was studying Arabic, yep. And at that point, that was in very high demand. And they ended up paying for my undergrad and graduate school. And I owed them 6 years in the Foreign Service, which was my dream. But it became pretty clear to me pretty quickly that my parents maybe didn't understand what diplomats did. That, in fact, what diplomats do is wait for the go-ahead to have a conversation with governments when it's already too late. Our foreign policy is so short-sighted and in the moment, and so, you know, similar to our healthcare system, right? Like, we talk about treating the symptoms without looking at the causes. And, you know, soon enough, after about 8 years in the service, I was really feeling like, you know, this isn't it. And I'd love to be the change from within, but while I'm an optimist, I'm also a realist.
Yeah.
And at the time, I for family reasons, I moved to Maine and started working in the lobster industry. To me, it felt like for the first time, I was able to say, hey, here's a set of problems that we're going to be seeing in 20, 30 years. Let's fix them now. And that's what we're doing.
I think this journey is really interesting because you had an idea at 6, which is amazing. And then you went off and actually pulled it off and discovered, yes, my interest is still to make things better, to try to change the world, have more peace. But then you found you were not in the vehicle that allowed you to do that. But I'm guessing you kept that interest with you. You're determined to try to make a difference. You're just looking for a different environment in which to exercise that interest or passion.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's no saviors in the world, no matter who claims to be those. Usually if they claim to be them, they have a horrible skeleton in their closet somewhere. But are there ways that I can help mobilize people to take hold of their own future and their own resilience? And this is not a hospitable place to live. There's nobody that's going to say Maine is easy living. Maine is is cold and it's northern, and you can't get there from here. That's something that everyone always says here, is you can't get there from here. You can't. There's nowhere you can go. But like, we're a resilient bunch, and what a group of people to be the innovators in climate change resilience and adaptation.
Before you got involved with Atlantic Sea Farms, I was really intrigued what you were doing at the Island Institute. What did you learn while working there? It seemed like it turned on some epiphanies for you about what you'd like to work more in. Can you tell me about that, what you were doing there?
Yeah, so I took the job at the Island Institute because basically they had no economic development programming at the time, and they were looking at this pretty imperative problem, which was that the Gulf of Maine is warming faster than 98% of oceans in the world. This is not a small statistic. It is warming so fast, and we are completely dependent on a lobster fishery. And as it warms, lobster larvae are no longer going to survive at the rate that they are now. Mm-hmm. So you look at California, you look at Oregon, you look at Washington, you look at Massachusetts, even look at Maine for other fisheries. We've fished all the fish. Like, that is something that we did wrong. In the Maine lobster industry, because it's owner-operator, because it's generational, what we've actually done is cultivate a huge explosion in the lobster population by what is, in essence, farming the bottom. We put back egg-bearing females. We have an upper and lower size limit. We have a trap limit. We're putting baits in traps. The lobsters are walking in, eating, and walking out. I mean, we have created an explosion in the lobster fishery. And we will still be facing a complete change in the industry as a result of global climate change that we can have no effects on at a local level.
So an industry like the lobster industry, unlike some of the other species of fish, longline swordfish and all the things that happen in that area, maybe attributed to that licensing thing where you can't sell it. Maybe it encourages you to take a much longer view generations out, which is pretty unusual in business today, and work on tactics like the notching in the females so you can't touch them for 6 years and then they're too big to touch them anymore. And you're guaranteeing a perpetual nature of an industry, which is fascinating, working on what you can control, but a lot of times there are macro issues you can't. There are bigger things there's nothing we can do about, and we've got to, resilience means acknowledging that too.
And it means diversification. I mean, you hit the nail on the head on all of that. And I think, you know, they used to fish for shrimp, gone. They used to fish for cod, gone. To be dependent on one wild fish is terrifying, even if the ocean wasn't warming. That's not natural. That's not how you build a business, not in fishing, not when it's 6 months, not when you can't do anything about that stock. And so I was hired at the Island Institute to start thinking through what could fishermen do in their off season. And so I started working with fishermen to think about opportunities in aquaculture, mussels, oysters, scallops, and seaweed. But with seaweed, the challenge being, like, no one's ever done seaweed in the US at scale ever. No one.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been wild harvest, but farming seaweed, it just hasn't been done in the US. 98% of all seaweed eaten in the United States was imported. And in 1990, if you would have gone out in Bozeman, Montana and tried to find sushi, you would have been hard up. Now you can go to the furthest reaches of Maine or Montana and you'll find sushi in the grocery store. You also find seaweed snacks in the 7-Eleven.
I had begged to differ. We had some gas stations that had sushi in 1990, little plastic. Well, I don't know where.
In 1990?
Yeah, but it was safer to eat the hot dogs for sure. But I used to see it. I never bought it. I love sushi now. We have a lot of good restaurants in Bozeman.
Yeah. To say there was an explosion in the mid-90s is almost an understatement. It was very rare in the early 90s in the U.S. for consumers outside of large cities. And even then, it was minimal. It was thought of as sort of a high-end kind of risky thing to eat. And then there was a huge explosion. And all of it is imported, a lot of it from China. And there's no traceability on where it's grown. There's no kind of knowledge about who's growing it. And that means that it's often grown in you know, compromised water with questionable labor practices. And it's imported in three forms only. So if you want to get seaweed, you can either get it in a nori sheet, which is wrapped around sushi or by itself. and seaweed snacks, which are delicious. And the third is the bright green seaweed salad, which if you look at the ingredient panel, is the exact same ingredient panel as Mountain Dew. There's nothing good in that product other than imported seaweed that's then rehydrated and then put in there. So
I'm moving my Mountain Dew can out of the view of the video right here.
Yeah. but that's 15 and a half aisles of the grocery store that have no seaweed in it. That's a huge market opportunity for American Grown Co. And in Maine, we have more coastline than the state of California. We have 4,000 tractors of the sea, is what we call lobster boats, that can do anything. We have that fleet that's not doing much in the winter, which is when kelp is grown. And we can create products that nobody's ever had as people are looking to make better climate decisions about their food. And they're more aware of what terrestrial agriculture is doing to our planet and what the food is doing to their health. And so started working with fishermen to get into seaweed. But at the time, there was no buyer in the country that could support a growth of an industry.
And this is really interesting. So I've traveled a lot around the world to different conservation places on lots of continents. And a pattern that I see sometimes, well-meaning, but it makes things harder, is they start with, hey, we can produce this product, honey or whatever it might be. And later on, start thinking about how do we drive demand for that product? It seems coming out of the Island Institute, you were thinking, I know we can do the seaweed. And that's about as long as you thought about it. Then it's who the heck's going to buy it? How do we drive demand?
That's it.
Talk about that in terms of a philosophy of yours.
You're right. It has to be systems thinking. It's a new industry. And I think we are absolutely building a new industry from scratch. And we have to think about it holistically. You know, to me, it felt like there was this, there's this opportunity to look at a full food system for the first time because it is a new industry that hasn't been done before. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be holistic. And it's not an oyster and it isn't fish. So we need to collect the seed. We need to grow the seed. So there's no like Monsanto, thank God, that we can call to get seeds. And then we have to teach farmers how to do it. We have to get them their leases. So similar to farmland, you can't just go out and be like, this looks good. I'm going to throw in some moorings and rope. The state needs to give you that lease in the ocean, in that space. And so we fill out all the leases. We help them, we'll help them support their strain selection. Then we need to pick it up at the dock. So then we have to drive the trucks. We have to figure out the best landing spots. We have to then bring it back to a facility where we can produce it into something. Because again, it's not oysters. I can't just like sort through it and put it in a bag. We have to turn it into delicious products. And then we need marketing and salespeople. So you need this kind of entire supply chain. And I think prior to, you know, me joining Atlantic Sea Farms and, or, you know, starting the brand Atlantic Sea Farms in 2019, there's a lot of people who were kelp interested, but there was not kind of a full systems thinking around it. So it had a failure to launch in general. People would get into it and get out of it and get into it and get out of it because it was so focused on, like you said, Sean, like, we're going to grow some kelp. And it's like, cool. Well, there's a lot more to it than that. And there is a playbook and it's in Asia. We can actually look to people who have done it before. And I think this Western white hubris of thinking we're the first people to ever do it is insane. But we are the first people to do it here in Maine with fishermen. And so our business model is different, but that doesn't mean we can't learn a whole lot about how people have been doing it for hundreds of years in Japan and Korea.
Yeah. I think this, the systems thinking idea in terms of how you're wired for looking at opportunities, you look at it through that lens. And I think you're right. It's unfortunate that a lot of folks have a great idea, but not thinking through those 18 other things that all have to, they're critical success factors. They have to go well. And someone's got to be babying and nurturing those things all the time. It's not, the product is a starting place. It's great, but it's only one component, right?
Yep. It's not even half of it. And so at the Island Institute, we started a fund. We invested in Ocean Approved, which was the first commercial seaweed farm in the country. They had two small leases in Southern Maine that they were farming on. Again, failure to launch. It sat there for about 10 years where they were learning how to farm seaweed. And then I was asked to take over after a founder transition in 2018. And that's when we brought on our farm partner farmer model. At the time, there were 30,000 pounds grown in the entire country, farmed seaweed in the entire country in 2018. Last year, we harvested 1 million pounds with 27 partner farmers.
Yeah, excellent. I think you've mentioned in some articles about you, you took the risk, and it definitely is a risk, to be vertically integrated, meaning you're trying to at least influence and sometimes control or own many parts of the value chain. And then I think what I've noticed around the world is people say, hey, we've got a product that somebody out there should want because it's a good product, it's good for you, et cetera, whatever. But they are reluctant to, I just want to produce the product. I don't want to have to deal with all this marketing. And aren't there contractors we can do that with? Why did you decide to take that risk to be get involved in all that? Somebody on your team has to be good at all that stuff. And that means you need more people, and there is the risk.
Yeah, there's always a risk. The bigger risk would have been not doing it and not doing anything. I was lucky enough to see all the things that people had done wrong prior to that in kelp. And to me, I mean, we don't have time to wait for a General Mills or a Unilever to decide that kelp is what they want. We don't have the time. Fishermen do not have the time. We are the market leaders. We are the first movers. So we took on that risk, but we also were able to find, you know, I have no money in my own right. And we were able to find investors who were very impact aligned that saw how destructive our terrestrial food system is and wanted more systems thinking and were willing to take a longer view on investment to say, this is something that matters. And that has enabled me to really build out a team of people who know a whole lot more than me about everything. At this point, I'm like, well, every single person here knows more than me about what we do in their specific area, which is exactly where it should be. We always say you don't need to be a kelp farmer to grow kelp. And we have a whole team of people who are growing kelp in very different ways.
Yeah. So you focused on the idea of making the coastline more economically resilient. Just for people who might have different definitions for that word, what do you mean by resilient when you think of a community or, like you said, your coastline? How do you define it?
You could think about all the eggs in one basket.
Mm-hmm.
And I think resilience means having several different levers to pull in a time of crisis. And what have the last 5 years taught us other than that crisis is inevitable? It's one of the few things that we know is inevitable. And the people who were able to get through it were the ones that were the most resilient, the people who were able to accommodate change. We saw incredible spreads in economic inequality because the people who didn't have the equipment to make decisions that could make them more resilient because they were dependent on service jobs. They were dependent on jobs where they had to go in and they got sick and they have no health care. And those people aren't economically resilient, and therefore they fell further behind, even further behind in a world, in a country where income inequality is our America. That is who we are. And it got worse during the pandemic, you know, but people with more money and more options can be more resilient. And we can build in economic resiliency for fishermen at a time of climate change when we know crisis is going to happen.
Yeah. And even when you say fishermen, I got the sense you're not even viewing it as fishermen. You're looking at people who have skill sets to make a living nearby or on the sea.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's also just a proof of concept and point too. I mean, I think Take the lobstermen and kelp and implant that in any sort of industry of skill. So, you know, for a long time in West Virginia and Pennsylvania, people were talking about just have coal, you know, old coal miners make solar panels. It's like, what? What is this shared skill set there? Like, people aren't widgets. America's gold is not its land, it's its people. And we have people with incredible skill sets that we don't value as a society in a way that leads toward resilience and adaptability. And we have here in Maine 4,000 plus lobster license holders that know the water better than anybody.
Yeah.
And that transition is actually fairly easy. And we've seen a lot of other people get into the water that aren't either mussel farmers or lobster fishermen or mooring layers that have tried to get in, and they just all fail. because they're not the skills, they're not the people who are skilled. And I think we're hoping to prove out a concept that this can be done far beyond the kelp and lobster industry. This is a proof of concept that if you invest in the people that have the skills and invest in the people that can be the leaders in their own resilience, it will prove to be a very good business decision and a good decision for the environment.
I realized for people listening who don't understand the whole kelp industry, to admit how naive I was, as soon as I started reading about you, I thought, she's farming kelp. Do they send divers down 200 feet and whack it off with a machete? How do they, you know, could you explain to people how in the world you do that? How do you get kelp out of this?
Yeah, sure. So we have a pretty thriving seaweed population here in Maine, you know, wild seaweed. It will eventually be affected by climate change, just like everything else in the ocean. But what we do is at the beginning of every year, we go out and we find reproductive kelp. We bring it back into our nursery where we take that sorus tissue, which is the reproductive tissue of the kelp, and we pick the parental material that is what we think is going to be the best grow out. And we pick about 10 pounds of wild harvest for every 400,000 pounds of kelp that we grow. So it's non-destructive. We bring it back. We make it feel like it needs to release all of its seeds. It releases those spores. Then those spores swim around and look for something to attach to. What we give it to attach to is PVC pipes wrapped in kite twine. It attaches to that. And then we give it 30 days, 12 hours daylight, 12 hours night. And we incubate it with fresh seawater every other day, changing out the tanks, you know, singing to them. And then we give it to our partner farmers for free.
And what do they do with it when you give it to them?
So we give it to them for free. They go out to the water, usually at around 40 to 60 foot depth in the ocean, which in Maine is actually pretty quickly off the coast. And they have moorings, big kind of cement blocks with a mooring ball at the top and 1,000 foot lines. So for 4 acres of farm, you put about 10 to 13,000 feet of line. So 10 lines of 1,000 feet or 13 lines of 1,000 feet attached to each end with the mooring. When they get that PVC pipe, they take that rope out of the water, they tie the twine to the end of that rope and then unspool it around that rope in the water. You reattach it to the mooring. It sits about 7 feet under the water surface and then you leave it there. You check it after storms. You make sure it's tight as the biomass gets heavier, because on that kelp line by April, sometimes there's 5 to 9 pounds a foot of that line. So it gets awful heavy. So you have to make sure you're tightening that line, making sure it's taut, making sure that it's getting all that sunlight, but it's grown with no pesticides, no arable land, no input.
Yeah.
It's nature that is doing the farming. It grows on that line. And then in April, they go out. They attach it to their mast and boom on the back of their lobster boat, and they take a knife and they cut it off the line. It goes into a salt bag, 1,000-pound bag. They put it back to the dock. We bring it to our SQF certified facility. Then we process it into value-added products for the commercial market. Couldn't get fresher. And those partner farmers have a buyback guarantee from us every pound of kelp that they grow.
So yes, people have their tractors, the boats, and they have a lot of experience on the sea, but this is different than lobstering. This is a different lifestyle. Take us through, how did you start talking to people who are saying, I'm a lobster fisherman, fisherwoman. This is what I do.
Yeah.
How did you start helping them open their minds to this possibility, which could happen in any industry, whatever it might be, anywhere around the world, getting someone to entertain something different? We as human beings tend to focus a lot more on what we might lose than what we might gain. So losing a way of life or having to change and having to learn something new in order to have a potential gain, maybe even re-rig your boat a little bit. How did you start?
I think I would start by kind of like almost reverse engineering the question to say, I didn't get anyone to do anything. I feel lucky that at 39, I've learned pretty quickly that you never can convince anyone to do anything that they don't want to do. And if it's your idea, they automatically don't like it 99% of the time.
Yeah.
And so what I did is not some sort of special sauce, but it's something that I think we're low on in America, is I just listened. And I remember being about 7 months pregnant.
Mm.
And I invited leaders because the leaders in the industry got there because they're respectful, they have integrity, and they have a lot of thoughtful, strategic, you know, a lot of strategic thinking. So I invited about six guys to my house and said, I'm going to shuck oysters until I learn the answers to this. And I said, it seems to me that there's some pretty immense fear in the lobster industry of what the future looks like because all the eggs are in one basket. And it feels like an opportunity might be aquaculture. So I'm going to shuck oysters until I learn from you guys, like what would get a bunch of fishermen into oysters? And I was not even through the first one where they all were like, just have them make money. And I was like, oh, I have four dozen oysters. Like, what do you mean? They're like, if there's a business model to it, then people are going to do it. Like, it's not that complicated. Just get a few guys to make money and then other guys will see it and they'll follow suit. So I got to work on figuring out with kelp in particular, like, what's the way to get people to make money? And what's the risk mitigation that a company would need to take on in order to propel the industry? And it's, we make the seeds, we give them out for free. There's your risk mitigation. And then we guarantee buying everything you grow, you're going to have a buyer. But then our risk mitigation is 27 partner farmers that are figuring out their new ways of farming and can try a bunch of stuff. And some of it's going to work and some of it's not. And that's okay because there's 26 others. If your kelp doesn't work, then we can all come together in a networking meeting the next year and say, okay, guys, what went right? What went wrong? How can we share with each other? Because if you all do well, that means we do well. And if we do well, you all do well. And then we can grow. And so we've created this very collaborative network that's basically based on the fact that people are profitable in a year or two. We're not yet. We're on our way. When you put people first and their family businesses first, then, you know, people are going to jump on board. So now we have people coming to us from ports in Maine where people are not necessarily the most progressive set, but they're calling us because they want to grow kelp because they heard that they can make some money. At the base of it, you know, these are people trying to support their families. That's why they work. That's why they work so hard. And if we can provide an answer to that, then the convincing is theirs.
You've been a lot of places in the world, particularly with your foreign service background. Do you think this is a ubiquitous phenomenon that you could do the same in other industries and other cultures and get people who are fearful of something, like you just said, lobster fishermen work, the conditions and having all their eggs in one basket? And start simply with, I got an idea how to diversify your income. Let me tell you about that.
Well, I think it was more like, I have an idea of a way that, you know, I want to build a business. Is this something you guys want to be involved in? Mm-hmm. This is the money you could make from it.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever tried to sell anyone on anything in the lobster industry. And then after the first year, when I showed up, and I did what I said I would do. Mm-hmm. And then the second year, when I showed up and did what I said I would do, even after COVID, the word got around. But I think certainly I think any industry, if you can get leaders in the industry who are respected and respectful and thoughtful guys or women to vouch for you in a way that has a lot of integrity and really kind of be open about the benefit it can bring, I think it can happen in any industry with anything. It just has to be true.
Yeah.
And I think in so much, in particularly in climate discussions, and I'm sure you are so deeply aware of all of this, like the climate bros that are out there, like none of it has the added benefit of being true. It all sounds great. Cool. Suck out a bunch of carbon from the atmosphere with a bunch of robots. Like, great, cool, whatever. Like, it's not true. Mm-hmm. You know, what we're doing is it going to reverse climate change? No. Is it going to make the world a little bit better locally? Absolutely. Is it the most climate friendly food you can possibly eat on the planet? Absolutely. If you're replacing your lettuce with kelp, you're choosing a better planet. But is it going to solve everything? Absolutely not. And I think if you just put your integrity behind what you're saying and you're true in what you're trying to do and it's proving to be the case, people will follow.
You have opinions about the current state of our food industry. In your opinion, I've heard you use the word it's broken. And I know you want your organization to be a part of taking it to a better place. Elaborate on that a bit, how you see the food industry and where should it go in the next 20 to 30 years?
You know, sometimes I say it's broken, which I feel like is a little bit old language because I don't even think it's broken. I think it's working exactly how it was set up to work. It's rigged. Mm-hmm. The biggest players funded by the richest people are getting richer and bigger while the rest of America suffers. They're putting sugar and fat and bad agricultural practices and pesticides and name your poison. It's happening because the system is rigged for the wrong people. And I think we're going to have to make different decisions about how we're doing it. There is nothing about our food system that's working for the vast majority of people. Americans are dying at an alarming rate from food-related diseases. Heart disease is the number one killer of Americans. That's a food disease. Cancers from all sorts of chemicals and pesticides, crazy agricultural practices and meat that is just methane and emissions and carbon destructions and soil destruction and habitat destruction. And it's resulting in climate change that's seeing people being killed by wildfires and floods. And like, we are dying from our food. And along with that, farmers are also poor. Like, I just don't see who this is working for. And I think if we can prove that you can choose to do the right thing and still do well by doing good, not sort of do good as a, like this 1% of the planet bullshit. Like, cool, you're doing 1% for the planet. Awesome. Where's the other 99% going? What are we doing? I have two boys. I have a 5 and 7 year old. 1% isn't enough. And I think that if Atlantic Sea Farms can be as successful as we want it to be, and it's not there yet, but if we can be as successful as we want to be and really show that we can do well, you know, there are companies out there that have done this with conventional agriculture. We think we can be even better because we're doing something that also doesn't need land and doesn't need pesticides and doesn't need water. And so I hope that we can show an example that others can then follow to innovate on more oysters, more mussels, more climate-friendly grains. You know, the work that you've been doing in land restoration that is also complementary with agriculture. There's so many positive stories out there, but very few of them have had a national impact. And that's where we're trying to aim.
Well, I think what I'm taking this is you're not in this to get rich. It's a for-profit company, but it's not just a capitalist game for you. You really are trying to change something big at the macro level, the food industry, through demonstrating on how, at scale, it could be different. The answers are right here if we just choose to build companies like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, that isn't my goal, is to have venture capitalists making a lot of money. Having said that, if we can prove that you can, then that also changes the way that people can look at investments, right? Like right now with venture capitalists, they look at investments and like, why invest in kelp when you can invest in some new canned coffee? Not to pick on canned coffee. I'm sure there is good canned coffee out there, but that's it. You know, sometimes we sit here and we're like, why can't we sell chocolate? Because it's easier. But it's not my goal. Having said that, again, I'm an optimist, but I'm also a realist. We haven't proven anything until people are trying to get in to invest in this business because it's doing so well and they want to be part of it. And so I want the General Mills and the Nestle's and all of those people to be using our kelp in their products, because I do want the venture capitalists to walk away from this and be like, I took a flyer on a woman-run company. 2% of venture funding went to women last year. Less than 2%, actually. But a woman-run company doing something that nobody has ever done before, that has put planet and people and consumers first, and I made a boatload of money from it, great. Then we've solved something. And so it's not the goal, but it has to be part of the tactics.
Yeah.
Not the end, but kind of the beginning of when we can call it a success, is when these companies can get excited about what we built because we've done well by doing good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're focused. I love this kind of thinking. You're focused on a single initiative, build a successful kelp company that has multiple positive benefits, shows what something could be like that's more valuable than what we're doing today in the food industry. A second thing you might do is help to drive much greater volume of venture money towards small businesses like this, towards any kind of CEOs, particularly female CEOs. So a single initiative that has a lot of multiple positive benefits to it. I want to talk about the CEO role a bit. You've done a lot of things in your career in the Foreign Service, but now you're the top executive actually running a for-profit business, and one that has, of course, many challenges ahead. Scaling anything, it's not easy. What do you see as the most important essentials of your role? What are the most important things you tend to stay focused on when, as happens with most leaders of rapidly evolving companies, there are probably way too many things coming at you every day and competing for your attention?
Yeah. I think what has been interesting to me is that I don't have the playbook of how CEOs are supposed to have their bottom line first. I am not looking at other CEOs to emulate my actions, which means I make it on my own. And it means it's my playbook. And it means we can be a different kind of company. I had an ambassador when I was at the mission to the European Union who was the youngest FCC chairman ever. And he was the first Black FCC chairman. And he was absolutely brilliant and kind and thoughtful and the exact kind of leader that I've always wanted to be. And I've been able to model so much of what I'm doing after what he inspired and the way that he treated people and the way every time someone walked into his office, he would get up and move around and lean in to hear what people have to say. And I'm never filled with the hubris of believing I'm the essential tool. What is the essential tool is that we have a group of people moving on the train in the direction to achieve something that honestly is sometimes feels impossible.
Yeah. My previous life before American Prayer, I got to work with a lot of leaders in various parts of the world. And just on my own observation, I find some of the most successful leaders put a high value on organizational culture. Maybe let me ask you a hypothetical. Say you somehow overheard a conversation between a visitor of some sort and talking to one of your team members. And the visitor asks, what kind of organization does Bree strive to create and maintain? What would you just love to think that team member would say?
That we're hyper-focused on our mission and we never sway from it. And everything we do is in service to that mission. That's what I would hope to hear. And yeah, I would be concerned if someone was talking about me as a leader, because that means we're missing the point. I should be able to get hit by a bus tomorrow and our mission continues to be just as important and key. That's the culture that we're creating. And I always get annoyed at those kind of, when you see on the back of boxes of brands, like, so-and-so had a son who really liked granola. And there, you know, I'm like, oh, it's about you, huh? You know, like, cool, you had a kid. That's so inspirational. Like, okay, but it's not about me. This is about our mission and what we're trying to accomplish as a team, whether I'm here or I'm not. And so being able to come in every day and continue to roll up your sleeves and do it. We have a culture of mission-focused people. You know, we started with two. Now we're 22. And this core team that's here is, I sometimes set goals for them that are actually impossible and they do them because they believe them. If I believe in them.
That's what entrepreneurs do. A couple of last things here. And then I know you probably need to wrap up and go out and be a part of that team and clean some tanks or whatever you're doing this afternoon. In those moments when you have a chance to take a few breaths, does what you're doing with Atlantic Sea Farms feel like it aligns well with your own personal values and your sense of purpose at this particular phase of your life?
In many ways, I feel like it is reinforcing of any purpose that can sometimes feel lost in your personal life. I think that we wake up every day, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years, and are absolutely pummeled with bad news. That's political bad news. It's social bad news, and it's climate bad news. And in a world where it's sometimes difficult to see where your impact can make a difference, I have the opportunity to look locally and know that with national effort, we can make a huge local impact. To be able to find that avenue in a time where it is very, very easy to want to hide under a desk, I get to look at my 5 and 7 year old and say, yeah, it's all really scary. It's all really scary. But look what I'm doing. It's not going to solve all the problems, but this is where I feel like I can contribute. And this is where I feel like I can make a better planet for you. And like that to me gives me purpose. Sometimes when it's very easy, I think for all of us, I don't drink, but to want to pour a whiskey and sit down and like binge watch like The Floor is Lava, right? Because sometimes that would be a lot easier than having purpose. And I don't, you know, I don't turn on the TV and I don't drink because I don't I don't need to. I can, in those moments, instead of turning to that, I can turn to something that really does truly make a difference. And I'm very grateful for that. And I walk the earth with a lot more humility because I have the opportunity to make that impact.
Yeah, absolutely. Bree, thank you for the time. I really appreciate it.
No, this was great. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you for listening to The Answers Are Out There. To find out more about Brianna Warner and Atlantic Sea Farms, follow the links in today's show notes. The Answers Are Out There podcast focuses on people who are successfully executing on innovative ideas to make the world a better place for nature, wildlife, and people. If you have an idea for a guest on our show, let us know through our website, theanswersareoutthere.com. And if you enjoyed today's show, please like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. Today's show was produced by Chrissy Bodznik. Our web manager is Sarah Saxton. Music was composed by Trace Ketterling.